heard that in Afghanistan, one of the things that happened was the Russian army picked the believing outspoken Christians for punishment to send to Afghanistan. And as a result of that, they started leading many Afghanis to Christ and started Bible studies and things among there. And so God put a witness into that closed country through the Russian army. Yesterday, I had breakfast with Gene and Irma War, and Gene was telling me that I've heard that many American servicemen are coming to Christ. But what I hadn't heard and had been praying about as a result of that news from Afghanistan is that Saudis and others would come to Christ. And Gene was telling me that he's heard news that they're having little Bible studies in their tents, and Saudi soldiers and others are slipping into the tents to sit in on these Bible studies. So, you know, God is at work. We can rejoice in what's going on in terms of the progress of the gospel in spite of the rest of this. And I have to tell you, though I anticipated war weeks ago, and though I felt that's the right decision, when I heard the news, I went into my office, shut the door, and wept. Because I am convinced this is going to be a bloody, bloody, drawn-out affair. And the early euphoria, as communicated by the media, has been very seductive and misleading, I think. Now, I hope I get proved wrong, but I'm not happy about where we are with this. No, I don't. Well, on to work. And I'd like to just give you four messages that I heard early as a brand new believer when I was just getting started walking with Christ. I came to Christ as a college senior, and then just months later, was in my first job as a construction superintendent and had an opportunity to share Christ with my boss. And he blanched. I mean, he just absolutely turned white. Looked at me and said, "Roger, you cannot be in business and believe that way." Then after that, I went in the military, and I was home on Christmas leave, and was in a Christian bookstore and bumped into an evangelist I had met just before I went in the service. And he asked me what I was doing. I told him I was in the Army. And he said, he just got this terrible, sad look on his face. And essentially, I won't go into all the conversation we had, but he said, "It's just impossible to live the Christian life in the Army." Then I got out of the military and went to work at Ford Motor Company. And in the process of interviewing, I think everybody, it's amazing. I got to the plant at 7 in the morning to go to the personnel office, and I left about 2:30 or 3 that afternoon after interviewing every level of management except the plant manager. And so a couple weeks later, they hired me. But in that process, I had shared my testimony, I think, with everybody that interviewed me. And so the production manager was the official guy, since I was going to work under his organization chart. And his final parting shot to me as I left his office was, "It's no Sunday school out there in that plant." And then the navigators came along. And they said, "Why give your life to building cars when you could be building men?" Now, let me ask you, what is the common message by Christian and non-Christian alike that I was getting in those early days? What can't be done?
You can't live in the world and serve Christ too.
That's exactly it. Christianity, faith, is okay in the church and in your private life, but it doesn't work anywhere else. And everybody, Christian and non-Christian, gave me that message. And so our problem is that we have brought into our faith a two-tier worldview, the sacred secular. The Bible knows no such distinction. God created all that we call secular, and in Genesis 1:31, he pronounced it all very good. Sacred versus secular is a false dichotomy. Spirit and matter are real distinctives. Mind is more than a couple of pounds of matter and electrical impulses. Heart is more than muscle. We're indeed physical, a few dollars worth of chemicals, but we are infinitely more as human beings. Speak of spirit and matter. That's a biblical distinctive. But sacred secular is an idea the world has generated which weakens biblical faith. There is no such concept in the scripture. Only in recent years has this idea received such widespread acceptance. I have on my library shelf a bunch of old books that I collected from England, and one of them is a tiny little 10-volume set on the world's greatest sermons. And it's fun to dip into that from time to time. But over 100 years ago, a Scottish pastor, John Caird, addressed the Queen in a sermon entitled Religion and the Common Life. Let me give you a couple quotes from it. When a man is learning to be a Christian, it matters not what his particular work in life may be. The work he does is but the copy line set to him. The main thing to be considered is that he learn to live well. And this one I love. Private religion may make one a good theologian, trained in the timid, effeminate piety that passes for righteousness in Christian circles. But he will never, in the highest, holiest sense, be a truly godly man until he has acquired those habits of daily self-denial, of resistance to temptation, of kindness, gentleness, humility, sympathy, active beneficence, which are to be acquired only in daily contact with mankind. Carry holy principles with you into the world, and the world will become hallowed by their presence. A Christ-like spirit Christianizes everything it touches. It is easier to speak religious words than to infuse all you say with the spirit of your faith. Great words from a man who clearly understood what the scripture teaches about our life in Christ and its impact wherever we go. For example, if I take 1 Thess 5:18 seriously, how will that affect me on the job? Some of you should know that one. It was an old TMS verse. We've got some gray heads in here who should know it. And I don't think it's in the new TMS, as I recall. But 1 Thessalonians 5:18, does anyone have that memorized?
I do, but I forgot. Get one of those gray hairs back.
Okay, this is the will of God. In everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you. Now let me ask you, if you take that seriously, how will it affect you on the job? This is a real discussion, it's not a rhetorical question.
Well, I guess we're to give thanks in difficulties.
Okay. Give thanks for Bob Sheffield. Yes.
There is a limit. It's impossible to live this verse.
Well, I know that there are several times that I find myself repeating that during the work day, and it's usually because there's a frustrating moment that comes up, a tense moment and stuff, and if you find myself, if I turn and say that, you know, repeat that verse to myself, then I find It kind of calms me down. It causes me to concentrate on what God's trying to do as opposed to the circumstances.
Okay, what you've just said is very significant. It causes me to look at this thing from God's perspective and what God's doing instead of just looking at the situation on the surface. What is going on here? And, umpteen years ago, as a new believer, I looked at that verse and thought, well, God, if it's really your will for me to give thanks and everything, then I'm going to ask you to do something for me. I'm going to ask you to give me reason to honestly thank you in all circumstances so that I just don't grit my teeth and say it just like a Pharisee so that I can say I said it. And it was that little dialogue between God and me that did exactly what you said. That is great insight, because immediately it put me in a position of searching. What is God doing here for which I can be thankful? And it began to transform my perspective on daily circumstances that were coming my way. Didn't make it always easier to respond. In fact, in the military, I had a company commander I still think, and did then and still do, think was actually crazy. And that was one of the most difficult situations I've ever been in, and I did not do well in that situation. I regret my responses to God in that. Overall, I guess some might think I did all right, but I sure didn't think so. The point of all this is that what God has called us to do, 1 Corinthians 10:31, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all for the glory of God. Richard Halverson, the chaplain of the U.S. Senate, is one of my favorite writers. And let me just read this letter he put out. Do all to the glory of God. The glory of God is not the expression of an arbitrary religious principle. Rightly understood, living for the glory of God establishes all other values. Valuing values is a fundamental virtue in life. Transvaluing values is a fundamental evil. Illustrated by the story of the prankster who hid in a department store at closing time and spent the night there. He stole nothing, damaged nothing. All he did was transfer price tags. Customers entering the store in the morning were amazed to find bone china, 10 cents, paper plates, $150, ermine coats, $15, Levi's, $3,000, solid gold jewelry, 25 cents, costume jewelry, $750, crystal, 15 cents, plastic glasses, $150, and so on. We all have a natural predisposition to do this. Fun and games, $5,000. Study, 15 cents. Loafing, $500. Praying, 25 cents, if of any value at all. TV, $1,500. Bible study, 2 cents. Etc., etc., etc. The glory of God is a penny. Personal success, whatever tag I want to put on it. Actually, God's glory is infinite in value, and when taken seriously, gives true value to everything else in life. The value I put on anything is the clearest index to my character. So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. That's a powerful letter, isn't it? Well, I've put together some key New Testament passages which relate to work. And what I'd like you to do is read through them carefully. And probably you need to make 3 runs through these passages. And each time you read through, I'm going to ask you to look for the answer to one question only. And when I hand these out, I'll go over this again, but just want to introduce the idea. The first time you read through, I'd like you to answer, what specific statements tell me what God's will is for me related to my work? So look for specific statements that speak of God's will related to my work. And then the second reading through will be what attitudes God expects me to bring to my job. And then thirdly, what purposes or goals does God expect me to have for my work? So I hope we have enough here. What I did was cut and paste NIV passages together. And there's a section there for you to make notes. So you can just highlight or underline and make notes in the margin. So the first time through, specific statements that tell me what God's will is for me relative to my job. And then secondly, as you read through, what attitudes God wants you to bring to the job. And then thirdly, purposes or goals. And what, just to highlight that, there's a lot of so that's. As you read through this, so you'll look for that and so that as you read through it on that third reading, and that will identify where he is some specific purposes or goals. So I'll let you go to work on that, and after you've had about three readings, which I think is going to take about 30 minutes, is that when we have a break, Ruth, or how were you... Okay, and then we could come back for some discussion. Like I'm a dog on a leash when I've got one of these things. Again, you have heard that one of the major problems we're facing, our soldiers are facing in the Middle East, haven't you? Every time they dig a foxhole, they hit oil. Yeah. Well, let's review this then and just have a little time of discussion to identify these various themes that are in these some of these key New Testament passages related to work. As you looked at through these passages, what were the things that struck you about God's will relative to our jobs and careers, whatever? Yes, Dean? Pardon? Contentment. Where did you draw that from? Wait a minute, I do want to develop this just a bit.
Well, the very first passage, the First Corinthians 7, I put down that it says, my work and social status are inexorably linked. I should be content with the status God has assigned to me, for it is His pleasure and will.
All right. So from 1 Corinthians 7, it's wherever I find myself in life, that whatever station, whatever background, however I find myself placed, understand that God had a hand in doing that, and I can rest content in that. Okay, that's excellent. Somebody said obedience? Yes, where? Okay. Obedience to whom, what, why?
Authority.
To authority. Now, again, let's expand on that a little bit rather than just one word answers. But when we think of obedience, what does that bring to your mind? And when you think of authority, what does that bring to your mind? What is God speaking about here? Yeah.
Well, I took 1 Corinthians 7:24, and kind of the way I apply it is stewardship and being made accountable in my position of responsibility, not only to God, but to those that I submit to. On the job.
Okay, so from 1 Corinthians 7, you see a responsibility of stewardship that gives you accountability to whoever's over you in the job as well as to God.
Yeah, and to my co-workers.
And to your co-workers. All right, excellent. Yes.
And from 1 Corinthians 7, if I have subjected my will to God, then whatever circumstance I'm in, the only thing I have to worry about is knowing His commandments. Mm-hmm. And being obedient to them.
Yes.
When my will gets out of line with God, that I get into tension.
All right, excellent. So the real conflict, usually, not always, but usually, is a result of my will in struggling with how I'm supposed to respond by what God has told me and just obeying Him, even though it seems to conflict with every emotion and every sense of reason that's in me. Okay, good. Yes.
You know, there's a freedom in that. There's a freedom in knowing I'm not accountable for what my authority does. Mm-hmm. I'm not accountable for my response. So it really limits where I place my emotions, where I extend my emotions.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can even think of that as I've struggled with issues of war and so on, and not just now, but because I was in the military. I came to the conclusion there are a whole lot worse things than death, and dying young or whatever. The gravest thing is simply to not come to Christ, and the next thing is to walk in disobedience to Him. And so, they're just things that are far of far greater significance than whether I live to be 90 or 20. And And others, God will hold others accountable for some things that, good. Any other things you see?
Well, I think the one that ties into that contentment, as I think of the employer, employee, or supervisor, subordinate, not only that I, as a subordinate, should submit to my leader and be content with the job that God has given to me there, but that I, as a supervisor, should be content with the people God gives to me.
Uh-huh.
And make the most of that.
Yes.
That job, that situation.
Okay. So it's in the situation, accept my supervisor as from God, those that are part of my team as from God, or whoever I'm charged with responsibility to, and seeing them from God, that adjusts my view of a lot of things going on.
Exactly.
Good, Hal. Very good. Okay, let me... just comment on a couple other things. As I, in fact, you see an outline that I put on the back of these sheets. And I had listed six, I think, on your outline. I've since added seven. At the bottom, I put 1 Peter 2:21. But one of the things that I see is in 1 Corinthians 7, in addition to what's come out, is that this idea of where I am when God calls me to him is, as a general rule, the place where he wishes me to remain. And God's call on my life is not a call to leave my career, to leave my station in life, to leave the social position I'm in. Rather, it's a platform that God intends for me to utilize for the progress of the gospel in that particular world. And I can rejoice in that. And the one thing that I see in 1 Corinthians 7, where he speaks to slaves, he says, now, if you have the opportunity for freedom, take it. So I've extended that to the general idea, if I have an opportunity for improvement, then I that God generally is saying, yes, make use of that opportunity. We've talked about those we supervise. Colossians 4:1 is doing right to those I supervise. In 1 Timothy 6:18, I've got some things in here relative to wealth, simply because in the ministry that we have to business and professional people, this is a real issue. And so here I simply said, if I have wealth, use it for good. And Titus, I've got down the thought of be absolutely honest. Now, folks, that's tough. Years ago, God spoke to me about lying from a clear passage, might have been Ephesians 4:25, wherefore putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbor. It could have been another passage, maybe in Colossians. At any rate, I said, Lord, I am not an out-and-out liar. I just don't tell people blatant lies. But I like them to believe things a little better of me than is really so. I like them to think things are going along better than they really are. And so I mislead people by my responses. And I pray that you'll help me stop that. And I was aware of an instance, and I just said, Lord, in order to hold myself accountable, what I promise you is that any time I catch myself doing that in the future, I will confess it to the person right away. The very next day, I don't even remember the specific details, but I was here at Glen Eyrie as what was equivalent of LDI, and I was working down in the what was then the dining room, and repairing a table or a chair or something. And a fellow that I was doing some additional work for in the community came by and asked me about it. And my response would have led him to believe that I was much further along than I really was. And so he walked on. Now, this happened to be a man I feared. As soon as those words were out of my mouth, I literally began to sweat. I just broke out in a sweat. And talk about being smitten by God. And I thought, oh, yeah, okay. Well, next time I see him, Lord. Because I thought he had left the castle. So I finished my project, packed up my toolbox, started to leave, and there he was standing in the doorway talking to somebody. And I thought, well, he's busy. I'll catch him when I come back. No. I've made this promise to God. So I went over and said, Jim, I've just lied to you. And explained what I had said and what the reality was. And Jim just said, well, thanks very much. I appreciate that. And I'm glad you told me. And instead of, you know, hammering me as I expected. But that was a huge step forward for me. But it wasn't the last one. I think the last time I went with fear and trembling is when I was working as Terry Taylor's assistant to Terry Taylor, and it was a little thing, almost so insignificant, but immediately God put his finger on it because we'd made a deal years ago. And I had to go to Terry Taylor and say, Terry, I'm lying to you. And, oh boy. But this thing of being honest in our work, it's a very clear statement of what God wants from us in our relations on the job. And then this idea of being... Yes?
I think what you're sharing there is just a very practical thing. And I hear questions from this from time to time, but I wonder if you might just share a little bit more of, the principle or practice in what you did on that. In other words, when God spoke to you about something, that you took action on it. Because I think sometimes we think, well, I really want to change, but... You know, I've got a long ways to go. And you've got a long ways to go. But that starting point there, and God's faithfulness in that, if we're willing to trust God, we really want to change, then God is going to do something for us.
Yeah.
Because I think oftentimes we're very negative and just think, you know, I can never change. But I don't know, you might be a little bit more, you might share with us on that particular principle, because I think in what we're talking about here, I think it relates a whole lot.
Well, it's just, I'm trying to think, where do I start on that one? How do I change? Why do I change? I suppose it starts with my conversion. I came to Christ because I was desperate. And I thought I was on the road to self-destruction. Now, outwardly, I had everything going for me. I was a recognized leader on my campus. I had the grades. I had the future in front of me. But I was, inside, I was dying. And I thought that my lusts and desires and weaknesses would probably destroy me. And I was terrified of what I saw inside me. And... Sorry. But to come to Christ and find deliverance and forgiveness and healing and strength and new life, to know that I was so completely loved, how could anyone not want to grow and walk with him? So I don't even know how to respond to a question of people not wanting to change. And then to discover that it was his design that I should be made like him. Romans 8:29. Well, that's overwhelming. To think that he would want to... And what I really wanted to be was a real man. I mean, a full human being. And that's what Christ allows us to be. It's the sin in us that destroys and weakens and damages and twists and cripples and perverts the humanity that is in us. And to be free from that, to be made really whole people. Well, maybe some of us don't. You know, Jesus did ask the man at the porticos by the pool, do you want to be made whole? So all I can say is from my conversion, my point of conversion, I had this great longing to be a different person and to be free from sin. In meeting the navigators, the great help I got was in Bible study, making practical application. And I might add that for a number of years, I thought I was building hypocrisy into my life because I'd write all these glorious applications, which I never did. They sounded great on paper. So I made another little pact that I'd try to make them simple one-step things that I'd do before we ever got to the Bible study discussion. But my little simple way of applying things, and I find it is dynamite in helping men that I'm working with. One is I ask them to simply write a statement state the truth. In other words, in the first illustration I gave you, God wants me to be completely honest. And then state my need. And my need is simply, I don't lie out and out, but I do mislead people by impressions that I give. And then three is state my action. And in this case, it was a one-step deal. The next time I catch myself doing that, I will confess it to the person. And it's obvious. See, I mean, that thing is indelibly printed on my life and memory because it was an experience that was transforming. And it was simply a one-time act. Now, that has carried over through the years, obviously. But I didn't say for the rest of my life I'm going to be more truthful. I mean, you know, that's an impossible goal. And so this is what I try to do to help people move forward. And then my only thought to motivate them. Let me give you another thought on this. I almost came on this by accident. When you think of yourself as a human being, do you identify, because of Christ's redemption, do you identify with Adam before the fall or with someone else? Who do you identify yourself with as a redeemed human being?
What do you mean?
With Christ. He is the last Adam. Adam was put to death on the cross. We do not revert in redemption to Adam in his innocence. We are made into the image of the last Adam, Jesus Christ. Our humanity is linked with Jesus Christ. Our redeemed humanity is linked with Jesus Christ, not with the Adam in the garden. And I think that's one of the reasons a lot of Christians are not moving forward. Their theology is screwed up and they're identifying their humanity with the wrong person. And Jesus Christ has redeemed us to himself that we might be part of a new humanity, the redeemed of God. And Christ, our elder brother, and he is remaking us in his image. It's our destiny to be conformed to him. And therefore, that's what Philippians 3:10 is all about, by the way, 3:8 to 11, 12, 13, where Paul is pressing toward the mark. What he's pressing toward is that in this present life, insofar as God gives him grace and strength, he is bending his every effort and will to be conformed to Jesus Christ. That is what he's talking about there in Philippians 3, about knowing Christ. Since it's the call of God upon us, I don't know what else to do. Hal, have I? Okay. All right. Let's go to just a few attitudes that you picked up. What were some godly attitudes that he expects of us in fact, charges us to display on the job?
Respect.
What does respect do for you when you receive it? Okay, it makes you feel good. It sure does. What else?
I think it enables me to do things I never dreamed I could do.
You bet. It enables you to do what you never thought you could do. Boy, that's a good one. Yeah, Dean?
It affects my attitude towards the person who's giving me that.
It affects my attitude. It affects our whole relationship, the whole atmosphere in which we're working together. Yes. That was going to be my next question. How do we show respect to one another?
I think one way is affirming.
Okay, by giving affirmation.
Submission.
Give submission. Acknowledge.
Accept them for their ability.
And I say acknowledgement of grace because there's some respect that's warranted because they're recipients of grace and they don't even have the ability to still be respected.
I missed part of that, Randy. I was still.
Acknowledge that they're recipients of grace, that really we respect them not because they have ability, but because they're part of the kingdom just like we are, and it's unmerited.
Mm-hmm. Carry out their orders.
Okay.
Politeness.
Courtesy. You know, just so many of these things come in now, because part of them are my weaknesses. Giving affirmation, acknowledging and accepting ability. One is by makeup and by background. My first instinct is to do it myself, and I know I can do it better and quicker than most. In fact, just about anybody. Yeah. And so that's my makeup. That's my whole background of being raised. And so consequently, in giving affirmation, that's a moot point for me because you're just doing what you're supposed to do, see? And so these have been areas that I've been working very diligently at. In fact, daily I'm praying in regard to the staff I supervise, Lord, grant me the ability, bring together the information and knowledge we need to maximize the contribution of every person on the team. Help me to see what they've got to offer. Bring things to my attention as we get together so that every person really is giving all that you designed them to give to this team effort, so that all over the U.S. more is happening than could ever happen just by my little bit of planning or by my going around to see people, but somehow help us to do that. And so I'm doing two things there. I'm trying to acknowledge first, understand what's there so that I can accept it and utilize it. And so those two go together. And then giving affirmation, it's interesting. According to the makeup of the secretary I have now, this is a great need in her life, to receive affirmation, to know how she's doing. It happens to be a great weakness of mine to give it. So I think God put us together to help one another. And so the only way I could see to do that was to schedule regular times to get together with her and to write on my note for those times, tell her what she's doing right. Tell her what I like. And I do more than that. But I had to start somewhere with me. The interesting thing is, in spite of my weakness, she had worked for the Navigators for some 8 years, and she said, Roger, you don't know what it's like to work for someone who gives affirmation. I've hardly ever heard a word in these years. And people who know her telling me how much she's blossoming in this job. And I'm giving her more and more responsibility all the time. In fact, she'll be gone a week, and I'm thinking, how will I make it? Because she's going to represent me at a conference that will train her in some areas that will really enlarge our capacity to operate in the office. So I'm pretty excited about all this. But it's been over these issues, as I've struggled with them, in order to show the kind of respect and honor that God wants us to give one another. Yeah.
Did you ever find yourself, you hit a wrong road and say, I can do it better?
That has to do with temperament. And so.
So a predicament that I think I maintain in giving affirmation is, well, job well done is reward enough.
Yes.
Basically, the subconscious attitude, what's the problem? So I know that's something I need to work on. There are chuckles around the room because there are people who don't. Do you find yourself having the attitude of, well, I got to do this, so I'll do it, but when does the attitude kick in to reinforce the action of serving somebody?
Well, I think what drives me, at least, is I think God has put a great desire in me to see people become all that God intended them to be. And I see this here as one of the keys to achieve that, because affirmation really does help build people up. It helps them understand what it is they have to contribute. You and I, by our makeup, don't need that. In fact, I really could. In fact, it's difficult for me to receive affirmation. Because personally, it's just part of my makeup. I get embarrassed. And my wife has done this for years. And, of course, she's made me 10 feet taller than I ever would have been. But I just, still, after 25 years of marriage, when Jean sits down and tells me what she likes about me, I'm because that's how I'm put together. But to assume that because I'm in the one half of 1% of people, or the 1% that operate that way, that everybody should be that way, is to impose on them my worldview rather than taking the biblical idea and operating by that. Yes.
I operate the same way you and Brian do, but I know I had to remember that I do get affirmed, because if I do a job well done, that someone says, "Gosh, that's great."
Yeah.
You know, and so I can't. I don't believe we really do. It's just we don't hear it the same way that other people
do.
We've been affirmed.
Yes, Hal.
Roger, you put people development. Now, how do you balance people development and getting the task done? Task orientation.
Well, let me put it this way. A book that I'd encourage some folks to read, not everyone, but if you're particularly in more management or executive level, would be Seven Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey. Now, it's a secular book. He is a Mormon. And so he writes with a spiritual perspective, but the Mormon spiritual perspective is, there's some flaws. And so, at least from my point of view. But what he has to say is dynamite. And he's got a little section in there on delegation. And his point is that if we're going to be productive people, or we want our businesses to be productive, our enterprises to be productive, then what we need to do is enlarge production capacity, and basically that means enlarging people's capacities. And so he says that effective delegation is the single most high leverage activity a manager can engage in, because what he's doing is developing people to expand their capacities. And in expanding their capacities, he's expanding the capacity of the team to contribute. So I see them as hand in hand. But delegation requires an awful lot of effort. It happens to be a weakness of those who think we can do it all. And so I've spent my 25, 26, 7 years, whatever it is, around the Navigators, trying to learn how to delegate effectively, in a way that others get to learn and grow and contribute through their job. And let me just use. Hal was my overseer when I was here at Glen Eyrie in 63 and 4. And in summer 64, I was made lawn crew leader. So what I did was get alone with God and ask the Lord what should be our emphases for that summer. What were the key things that I needed to work on with this crew of people whom I didn't know and hadn't met hadn't even been picked yet? And so I went through Proverbs, since I thought, well, there's where I'll find most about work. And I think I ended up with three or four things that I felt these are the themes that I believe God would have us emphasize this summer. See, I made some notes on this, so I might not forget what I'd like to set out. Then I tried to think through what is my role for this crew, and what goals and standards should we have for our work. And then when they got together, tried to lay out for them what I thought we ought to try to do that summer as a crew, of learning how to operate together, how to function as a team, how to work with standards of excellence, diligence, and that I wanted us to have fun, as well as discovering the experience of God with us through the day. And so we would start each day as a crew with some sharing from the Word and prayer, and I'd give them their assignments and then supervise through the day. When we first got started, the guys were putting in about 10 hours or more a day to get the job done. By the end of the summer, we were doing more work than we had done in 10 hours in about 6 hours a day, and I was scrambling to find work for them to do. But what I started doing was giving them, I thought, the reward for this should be take time off. Go spend more time in Bible study or go see somebody. But take the time. You've earned it. And then I got hammered by another supervisor because we weren't working hard and their crew needed some help and I wasn't being a good servant. But what I'm trying to get at is that through the summer, I began to give different responsibilities to members of the crew, and in delegating things to them was enlarging their contribution. And they were learning how to respect one another and receive from one another. When I put the first guy in charge, I thought, this is going to be interesting. When I put him in charge, because here's a guy that was being groomed by his dad and political cronies to become the next senator from the state. And here's a guy that has just come out of the military as an officer who has all this leadership, and I'm going to put this other guy in charge, and I know what is going to happen in their hearts over all this. And they did. And through that process, we began to work on attitudes, how to relate to one another, how to receive from one another, how to submit. We more and more over the summer we came together, and the wonderful thing to me is that all these years later, I'm in touch with all but one of those men. And in fact, the one I put in charge of the crew is one of the Nav missionaries, and whenever we see one another, he still talks about that summer and what it meant to him and what a wonderful time that was. But what I'm saying is this thing of task, the task went from 10 hours to actually accomplishing more in 6. Now, that's significant progress in work skills and teamwork and all the things that were related to it. So that was a highlight for me. One of my life highlights was that summer, just the joy that we had working together. Does that bring task and people together, Hal?
I think very much.
Okay, let me go back here to attitudes. We started out with respect. We didn't get much further. In fact, as I went through this, that was one of the key ideas in there, wasn't it? to show respect. It comes out over and over and over again. And then obedience. So it's a very powerful thing. And I might note that at this last president's conference, we got together with a couple. Well, I was telling Mark Seltzer about this. It's you never know. 6 months ago, we did a seminar in their town, and they had just that week come to Christ. And their divorce was in the courts when they came to Christ. So they pulled it out and have been trying to rebuild life with great difficulty. They are being discipled, quotes. And from our interaction with them over the meal, I thought, there's an awful lot of strain here. Not on his part, but on hers. And we need to get together with them. So we figured out a time to get with them. Went to their room. And so I just sat down and we chit-chatted a couple minutes. And I said, now, we don't have a lot of time, but the real reason I came is to find out, how are you two doing? Well, in the next hour and a half, three times, his wife exclaimed in the middle of something, you're the first people, the only people, that have asked us about our marriage. Now, they are meeting weekly with a couple that's discipling them. Now, you would think, given the background of where they came from when they came to Christ, that the first thing people would want to get into is how Christ relates to their marriage, and nobody's even talking to them about it. The issue, she called my wife this morning. I was there doing a little review of all this and trying to get a quiet time in, and she just wanted to thank us again, tell us again that we're the only people that have asked us if we could please come and spend some time with them. And the key issue in their marriage for her is right there. And it's destroying her, it's destroying her relationship with his kids, it's destroying their relationship as man and wife. And there's no reason. Well, there are always reasons, I suppose. But in terms of what it means to be a Christian husband, I've got to help this guy. He's got to hear some things, and he's got to take some action if he has any desire to see his marriage grow and bloom, and if he wants to see his wife become. I think of some marriages. I don't know, most of you aren't married, but as I've watched marriages, I see some wives kind of shrivel up and kind of hang like a dried up flower on a stem, and I see others that just, it's like they've been planted in rich soil, and their lives begin to expand and grow, and you can just see what's happening. And it has to do with love and respect and their relationship with their husband. So those are, it's a crucial issue. Let's see, did I say goals? We haven't talked about those, and we've got 5 minutes to finish. Okay, what are some of the goals that you see that are laid out for us that God wants us to accomplish through our work?
Be right and fair.
Dependable. World pagans give God glory. You've probably heard that the People's Republic of China wants Christian teachers. Do you know why? They obey the laws, they respect the people, they care about the people, and they try to do a good job. They're dependable. The pagans that go in there for what they can get out of it. And so they quickly figured out who's going to give us what we really want. And,
reward from God.
Sure. Work for God's glory, God's reward. One thing that I haven't heard from 1 Thessalonians 4:11, win respect, that you might be respected and earned respect. And boy, I've heard more horror stories about Christians and work. And I know a Christian man who will not hire Christians because they don't give a good day's work for their wage. And they think they're there to fellowship. And I've talked, that was several years ago, so I've talked with others just recently, and it hadn't changed much. There are exceptions, and really wonderful exceptions. But I know, I'm in a little network of Christian auto dealers, and you say, auto dealers, Christian auto dealers. You wouldn't believe how many of these guys I'm in touch with have been shafted by Christian partners and other Christian dealers. And they don't like to do business with them because they can't depend on their word. And so it's a fascinating business world. But the issue is because people make no connection between what happens in church on Sunday or their Bible reading, if they do it, and what goes on in their day-to-day affairs. They're absolutely unrelated, and they see no connection. And they don't even realize they see no connection.
I think sometimes it goes beyond that. Huh? And that's the, I don't know if it still exists here or not, but where there before there were what they called the Christian Yellow Pages.
Yes.
And I just refused to use them because there were Christians who were actually using their I'm a Christian so they could have the opportunity to take advantage of you.
Yes.
And it wasn't just a subtle thing, it was a very overt thing.
Yeah. Well, so we need to win respect because we win people to ourselves before we win them to Christ. And I feel like I've spent my 30 years plus as a believer. Maybe it's just the circumstances God has put me in, but I've spent in fact, I've spent all those years overcoming what other Christians have done to gain a hearing with unbelievers. And I've had to spend time breaking down walls of past experience with Christians in order to get a hearing for the gospel. So it's win respect. And then another thing in that passage is not be dependent on others. So we should earn a decent living or an adequate living, and that enables us to get ahead. And I can give you story after story. Wherever the gospel goes, the socioeconomic situation for people that come to Christ is raised. Wherever the gospel goes. And Gene Warr was giving me a little word on what's happening in Brazil among some of the lower classes. And what's happening, in fact, it was in Forbes magazine, a big four-page story about what's happening, not a Christian magazine. And what he's talking about is Brazil's a place of the future for investment. Why? Because the gospel is having great impact among the lower classes. And it's cleaning up their acts. The husbands are no longer spending their money on prostitutes and drink and drugs. They're bringing it home. They're saving. They're providing for the future education of their kids. There's going to be a huge surge in a middle-class population because people have gotten their lives straightened out with Christ. Interesting, isn't it? I can't remember. I'm going to have to look it up. But Gene Moore told me about it. And I thought, oh, boy, I've got to go check that out. Forbes magazine. So win respect, not be dependent. Honor God, honor His teaching. You know, it does open opportunities for the gospel. One other thing that I noted, we had somewhere in here about money in our last discussion. But in 1 Timothy 6:5 and 9, when I was thinking about goals, I inserted that as a negative goal. Our goal should not be to get wealth, to get rich. Now, God gifts some people to really make money, and that's fine. But if that's a goal, that's a different issue. And so that should not be one of my goals. All right, now what I'd like to do is hand out another thing. And I do not remember when I developed this, but it had to do a few years ago when I was doing something on work. And what I did was based on some studies I'd done relative to work, I thought, well, now if I wanted to grow in this area, what would be some sample objectives that I would write out and that I could help people with? And so all this is a set of sample objectives to maybe stir the pot a little bit, to stir your own thinking about what you might want to set out for yourself or what you might want to help others with. And I see there's, I've written a note on mine that came as a result of a conversation this past weekend with one of the businessmen here. And after he came to Christ as a man in his 40s, he struggled with what makes it Christian. Now he said, I used to give to the church. I still give to the church. What's the difference? Is that a Christian act before and after? I used to do these things that were good for my employees. I still do those things that are good for my employees. What's Christian? What's not Christian? What makes the difference? And the one word he gave me was attitude. I won't go into all the rest. So what I've done here is to set forth some possible objectives for people to grow, to develop and demonstrate scriptural attitudes on the job. One, to work as unto the Lord. There is nothing more fundamental to transforming your understanding of work, your understanding of God with you, your understanding of excellence, your understanding of what it means to be free to disagree as well as to agree in dealing with bosses, as knowing that I'm working as unto the Lord. And to raise the level of excellence on and on and on, there's nothing that will change us more like that. And because of time, I won't go into how God taught me to begin the pilgrimage in that area. To honor my bosses, we've talked about that. To maintain a standard of excellence, we haven't really talked about that, but it follows from the things we've discussed. We want to honor Christ. We want to gain respect. To be wholehearted and diligent in my work, Colossians 3:23, if I'm working to the Lord. To be highly proficient in my field. Proverbs 22:29. Seest thou a man diligent in his business, he shall stand before kings. He shall not stand before mean or lowly people. To learn all I can about my job, let me give you two quick illustrations. I was enlisted in the Army, and I was made a clerk typist. And I tell you, there's nothing in my life other than being a Christian worker that I wanted to do less. And honestly. But I could do the work they gave me in about 2 hours, and so I had all the rest of the time to figure out what to do with. And I decided that it was it would dishonor God for me to sit around and read my Bible and do all that kind of stuff that people do on the job and think they're spiritual. That the Army was paying me for 8 hours a day and I needed to give it. And so I started reading and studying in things related to my job. As a result, I became an expert in the area of Army filing systems. And so once they discovered that I could make the filing system so good that they never got any demerits from the big annual inspectors general when he'd come down and look for everything, they decided to use me to go to first to all the companies that were in our battalion and then to the post. Do you know what that did? It gave me a witness in the entire post. God enlarged my witness beyond anything I'd ever dreamed. I had started out trying to go, you know, once a week I'd pick a barracks, I'd go there and just walk through the barracks and pick people off and share Christ. And that was my way of trying to get my witness out to the post. And it had its limitations. But through my job, God brought me to a place of honor. In spite of the fact that it was a job I hated, that gave me access to all the units on our post and gave me testimony with officers and enlisted alike, and it was just an interesting thing to see that happen. So then, by the way, to learn all I can about my job, how often I go into a store. In fact, it even happened here at the Glen. I went in to get some help on something, and the person that happened to be there said, "Oh, I don't know." Well, do you know someone? Well, no, don't. Do you know where I could go to look? Well, no, that's not my job. If you want to get my ire up, I think that is abominable to God. That you would take no interest at all in what's going on around you and learn more about the sphere in which God has placed you so that you become a more capable, more contributory individual in that arena. And then finally, to become skilled in human relations. Proverbs 22:11, it says, "He that loveth pureness of heart, for the grace of his lips, the king shall be his friend." The real secret to effective human relations is pureness of heart, love for others. That's what God gives us. Christians, of all people, ought to be the most skillful in human relations, not because we're good at all the ins and outs of how to draw people out, how to converse, but simply because God has put pureness of heart into us and his love. And people read that. They read it without us saying a word and are drawn to us because of it. And then to live out Christian standards. Well, hope this gives you something to chew on and work with as you think about your walk with God and how it's going to impact your work world.